Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Aging Out Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 9, 2014, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Chialaba v. Cuellar de Osorio, formerly Mayorkas v. Cuellar de Osorio. This case involved two questions. First, whether Section 1153H3 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which provides rules for determining whether particular aliens qualify as children so that they can obtain visas or adjustments of their immigration status as derivative beneficiaries of sponsored family member immigrants, also known as primary beneficiaries, unambiguously grants relief to all aliens who qualify as child derivative beneficiaries at the time a visa petition is filed, but age out of qualification by the time the visa becomes available to the primary beneficiary. The second question in this case is whether the Board of Immigration Appeals, or the BIA, reasonably interpreted Section 1153H3. Although the District Court deferred to the BIA's determination that only those petitions that can be seamlessly converted from one family preference category to another without the need for a new sponsor are entitled to conversion under 1153H3, the en banc Ninth Circuit reversed, holding that the provision unambiguously entitled all aged-out derivative beneficiaries to automatic conversion and priority date retention. By a fractured vote of 5-4, the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit. Justice Kagan announced the judgment of the court and delivered an opinion, joined by Justices Kennedy and Breyer, concluding that the BIA's textually reasonable construction of Section 1153H3's ambiguous language was entitled to deference. The Chief Justice, joined by Justice Scalia, agreed that the BIA's interpretation was reasonable, but not because an agency has authority to resolve direct conflicts within a statute. The BIA's reasonable interpretation of Section 1153H3 was simply consistent with the ordinary meaning of the statutory terms, with the established meaning of automatic conversion in immigration law, and with the structure of the family-based immigration system. Justice Alito dissented. Justice Sotomayor dissented, joined by Justice Breyer in full, and Justice Thomas except as to footnote 3. To discuss the case, we have Margaret Stock, who is an attorney with the Anchorage Office of the Cascadia Cross Border Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Ms. Stock.
Immigration law is notoriously complex and difficult and dysfunctional. One federal court called it famously King Minos's labyrinth in ancient Crete. In the newly decided case of Chialaba versus Cuellar de Osorio, decided on June 9, 2014, the Supreme Court entered the labyrinth again, this time to interpret a law passed by Congress called the Child Status Protection Act. The CSPA, or CISPA as lawyers call it, was intended to rectify the injustice created when long waiting periods for immigrant visas caused some children to age out of their eligibility for a visa. The children turn 21 and are left behind when their parents immigrate legally to the United States. Due to the Supreme Court's ruling, however, these children will now continue to be left behind, most for another 10 or even 20 years. So here's some background on the case. The United States has limits to the number of immigrant visas issued annually to people from any single country. As a result, some people waiting to immigrate legally experience waits of many years, in some instances, decades, between when they file an immigrant visa application and when a visa is actually issued to them. To address one problem caused by the delays, Congress in 2002 amended the Immigration and Nationality Act by passing the Child Status Protection Act, or CSPA. The CSPA establishes certain rules for determining whether particular children who initially qualified for visas can obtain visas despite turning 21. Immigration lawyers call this aging out. Once someone's 21, they're no longer considered a child under the immigration laws, and so they can lose their eligibility for a visa that they previously were eligible for. So here's an example of what happened to one family, and this is the family that's named in the case, the Cuellar de Osorio family. Rosalino Cuellar de Osorio and her family waited 7 years for immigrant visas that would allow them to join Rosalina's U.S. citizen mother in the United States. The mother had sponsored Rosalina legally, and Rosalina had been on a very long waiting list. The family was notified that they were next in line for visas, but they were also told that Rosalina's son, who had turned 21 while the application was pending, was no longer a child for purposes of the immigration laws, and therefore he was not eligible for a visa, and he could not immigrate legally to the United States with the rest of the family, so he was left behind. The Board of Immigration Appeals interpreted the statute to permit the issuance of a visa to an aged out child for some, but not all, of the family visa categories. And the son happened to be in one of the categories that the board said was not eligible for retaining the priority date for the visa. So the son happened to be in a category that wasn't covered by the law, according to the Board of Immigration Appeals, so he could not come with his family. And there was an on-bank panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit that disagreed with the Board of Immigration Appeals and concluded that the Child Status Protection Act unambiguously grants relief to aged out children because the board's interpretation conflicts with the language of the statute, and so it was not entitled to deference. And the government then appealed, and this caused a little bit of confusion with the name of the court case, because when the government appealed, it was the agency head whose name appears as the first party in the case, but the name has changed over the course of the lawsuit. So that's why we're referring to this case as Cuellar de Osorio. That name has not changed. And the question before the court was this one: do derivative children who age out before the principal beneficiary immigrates retain the original priority date when their parent becomes a green card holder and files a new petition on their behalf? And the answer in some categories has been no, based on a Board of Immigration Appeals decision called Matter of Wang from 2009. In that case, the Board of Immigration Appeals ruled that there's no appropriate category to which aged out derivatives other than the ones in one category could automatically convert. So they basically said out of the five family preference categories, children who age out are simply out of luck unless they fall into one specific category. The Second and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had ruled differently, however, relying on a more generous interpretation of the statutory language and also relying on congressional intent. As a side note, a group of congressional representatives filed an amicus brief in the case arguing that a more generous interpretation was their intent when they passed the statute. However, the United States Supreme Court disagreed. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit and found the language of the statute is ambiguous, and therefore the court deferred to the agency's interpretation of the law. Supreme Court held that the immigration law allows for the different treatment of aged out children depending on their preference category. And in accordance with the Board of Immigration Appeals decision and the agency interpretation, only children in one specific category of the five family preference categories, and not those in any other family-based preference category, are allowed to keep their original place in the line. Now, to explain this further, it takes a little bit, so let me try to do that. There are five family preference immigration categories where children may potentially age out. The agency interpretation only allows one of the five categories, the unmarried derivative children of green card holders, to convert to a new category when they turn 21. They automatically convert and they don't have to file a second petition. Should a petitioner file a second petition, however, they would get the original priority date that they had. For other aged out derivatives, however, when the parent immigrates and files a new I-130 visa petition, there's no retention of the original priority date. So in 4 out of 5 categories, as a result of the Supreme Court's decision, there will be huge waiting times of many decades, and families will continue to be split apart. The Supreme Court plurality applied Chevron deference. This is a doctrine that says when a statute is ambiguous, the court will defer to the agency's interpretation of the statute. And they did this to uphold the Board of Immigration Appeals' restrictive interpretation of the Child Status Protection Act. Now, the problem for the court was this. Congress drafted a statute that was not very clear. Justice Kagan provides a copy of the statute in a footnote to the plurality opinion, and she states in the opinion this copy is only, quote, for the masochists among this opinion's readers, end quote. The immigration agency took this unclear statute and chose an agency interpretation that was substantially different from the interpretation that Congress said it intended, but Congress drafted the law badly. So applying Chevron deference, the Supreme Court upheld the agency's interpretation. So I mentioned this was a 5-4 vote, and here's how things broke out and what the arguments were. There was a plurality opinion written by Justice Elena Kagan. She wrote this opinion and announced the judgment. She was joined by Justices Kennedy and Ginsburg. Justice Kagan said that principles of Chevron deference apply when the Board of Immigration Appeals interprets the immigration laws. And of course, this is from the famous Chevron USA Incorporated versus Natural Resources Defense Council case from 1984. Justice Kagan said that, quote, judicial deference to the executive branch is especially appropriate in the immigration context, end quote, where decisions about a complex statutory scheme often implicate foreign relations. Justice Kagan engaged in an exhaustive analysis of the statutory text. She then concluded that the text is ambiguous and subject to, quote, internal tension making possible alternative reasonable constructions. She concluded that this is the kind of case Chevron was built for. Were we to overturn the board in that circumstance, we would assume as our own the responsible and expert agency's role. We decline that path and we defer to the board, end quote. Justice Roberts filed a separate opinion concurring in the judgment. He was joined by Justice Scalia. Justice Roberts agreed that the BIA's interpretation of the statute was reasonable, but unlike the plurality, he said there was no conflict or internal tension in the law. In his view, the board's reasonable interpretation was consistent with the ordinary meaning of the statute. Justice Alito filed a dissenting opinion. Justice Alito thought the board's interpretation was contrary to the statutory text and thus not entitled to deference. And finally, we get to the major dissenting opinion. This was Justice Sotomayor. She wrote the dissenting opinion, joined by Justice Breyer and Justice Thomas. In her view, quote, because the court and the Board of Immigration Appeals ignore obvious ways in which the provision can operate as a coherent whole and instead construe the statute as a self-contradiction that was broken from the moment Congress wrote it, I respectfully dissent, end quote. So we have it there, a confusing statute, badly drafted, that the Supreme Court had to interpret, and they chose to defer to the agency's interpretation. So that's a quick summary. The most interesting part of the case, however, for an immigration lawyer, actually involves technical errors in the plurality opinion. Justice Elena Kagan, the former dean at Harvard Law School, gets stuck a few times in the immigration labyrinth. She repeatedly uses incorrect terminology, confusing an immigration sponsor, someone who's financially responsible for an immigrant, with an immigration petitioner. At one point, she even boldly misstates the law regarding jumping the line for an immigrant visa, apparently because she's unaware of several complexities of the immigration code. Laura Murray Tijan, an immigration law professor at Boston College Law School, recently wrote a column in the Huffington Post in which she pointed out that, quote, immigration law is almost impossible to master. It's a messy patchwork of compromises stitched together over decades, a shotgun wedding of often incompatible provisions. Whatever metaphor you pick, the reality remains the Immigration and Nationality Act is complex, counterintuitive, and just plain confusing, end quote. Professor Murray then went on to describe many cases in which the federal courts have made errors when describing immigration law in their written opinions. With the newly decided case of Cuellar de Osorio, Professor Murray can add yet another Supreme Court opinion to the list of ones in which the court has made errors of immigration law. The net result of this one, however, is that many more children will be left behind when their parents immigrate legally to the United States.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.